Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Bumper tunes, and in case you are not familiar with who that was that we were just listening to, it would have been the great Etta James singing a great classic by the great Marvin Gaye. Yes. The question is, what's going on? That is the question. And, well, this evening, hopefully we'll address that. And again, for those of you who are just joining us, that bumper tune that we heard to open up was What's Going On by the great Etta James. Of course, originally done by the great Marvin Gaye. And it's so apropos that we opened up with that particular cut, because we're going to have some discussion this evening about just that. What's going on? And I would be remiss if I didn't say I am thrilled. Well, you've heard me say that before, but truly, I am thrilled with tonight's program because of our special guest. You know, I do this out of love and gratitude, and I've been doing it now for 9 years. And most weeks we do have a special guest that highlights the topic for the evening. And this evening is no different, with the exception that this evening, as has been in the past from time to time, I have the opportunity to have on the program someone that is not just a person I respect and has the acumen to have a discussion about the topic, but she's a colleague, she's a mentor, she's a friend, and truly she's a remarkable mind, as you'll soon see. And no, I haven't mentioned her name intentionally because I want you to get on my mail list. I want you to send an email to me at Daryl, D-A-R-R-Y-L, underscore C-L-A-1-8 at msn.com so that I can add you to my mail list so that you will know in advance who will be on the program and what the topic at hand will be. Oh, by the way, did I tell you, you are at the right place at the right time, and your host, yours truly, myself, is Daryl Clark. And thank you for taking this time out to join me again on another edition of Progressive News Weekly, where we bring you news and information that's gathered from, for the most part, around the country, but sometimes we cross the borders and it becomes international. And so this evening, as I was mentioning, we do have guests that I'm going to really take pleasure in interviewing or having a discussion with, because it's going to flow so gingerly, just because of the respect that I have for the individual. And so before I go there, though, just to sort of set the stage, is anyone wondering what's going on with our political arena? Well, don't wonder too much, because it is what it is, folks. All right? Is anyone wondering what's happening with technology? Like, for example, I had some challenges with my technology over the last week or two or three. And I've noticed several of my colleagues, friends, family, associates have also. So is this like some cyber war going on? Eh. You know what? I wouldn't sweat that either. Has anyone been concerned about, well, the quality of life, period? food, products, not being what they used to be. You know, there was a commercial once that was out and said, things are getting thinner all the time. And you'd see, you know, grocery bags with the bottom falling out, and then they would go on to, of course, advertise their product, which is as high a quality as ever. But things are getting thinner. And when I say thinner, that's generally speaking, in that the quality of things just seem to be diminishing too much. And some things are getting better. For example, we'll have a little bit of a discussion about this with our guest, too. I think there's something to be applauded in some facets with regard to the food. There's been a little bit of an uptick. You're now seeing some things advertised that they're genetically modified now on foods, and it'll say non-GMO, which is a good thing, which you weren't seeing 5 years ago. So, you know, just because of voices like yours and mine, you know, we can see that there are some differences made, but I would dare say we're not making enough of a voice, because there's still much, much work to be done, which does lead me into the conversation with our special guest this evening. This topic that we're talking about is somewhat generic, but yet it's crucially important. It's simply about our well-being. It's not complicated. It's simply about our well-being. And when I say our, I mean our society. And that's what I'm referring to, our society. So, I bring you this evening, as I said, friend, colleague, mentor, Miss Deborah Dow. She's actually been on the program before, having some discussion about sustainability, and I believe we were talking about healthy food at the time and the food supply as well. And we're going to get into some of that as well this evening. But as we move out of winter and into spring, I thought it would be a good conversation, especially being the last week of Women History Month, to have this remarkable lady to have some discussion about us taking a look, having an uncommon conversation about having a balanced, healthy life, especially us here in the United States, one of the most wealthiest countries in the world. And so Ms. Deborah Dow is going to have that discussion with us as we go into that. So, I'm inviting you to join us and participate in that, if you would. And so, that's what's going to happen for this evening. So with that said, let's get started, won't we, as the saying goes. Deborah, are you here? And so for those of you who have not dialed in at this point, you hopefully will be able to, or you may not be able to. But no matter what, you'll be able to catch the archives. So with that said, let's get started. And Deborah Dow, are you there? Let's see. We can bring Deborah on with us now. It's live, folks, all the way live. Deborah?
Hello, Daryl. Hi.
There you are.
Yes, here I am.
So, Deborah.
Well, yes?
What a pleasure to have you back on Progressive News.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
I guess you heard a little bit about, you know, what I'm hoping that we can have a simple discussion about this evening. You being one of, and I just want to start off with this, because I know it's one of the areas that you're well known for, and that is your affinity and your advocacy for growing health sustainable food and gardening. So can you give us a little bit of background as to how you found yourself going into that area, and you are considered by many a specialist or expert in that area of growing healthy, sustainable food. How did that come about?
Many people don't know that I started life basically on my grandfather's farm. It was not a working farm, but we were in South Plainfield, not far from Plainfield, and they would not put utilities in because they were trying to take our land. So even though we were landowners, we lived like people had lived in prior centuries. So I learned to read by a kerosene lamp. I knew, got well water. We had chickens. We had rabbits. We had peacocks in the yard. And we lived like our ancestors had lived, which included a lot of skills that people don't seem to have anymore. And every year we canned stuff in mason jars. We made jams and jellies. And I learned to sew on a pedal sewing machine that I still own today. So you didn't need electricity to sew. You just pumped it with your foot. And my mother was a home economics teacher, and she believed that our salvation was these skills, that it wasn't so much she educated us to be academics as much as capable of performing functions. And I'll tell you a funny story. She made my brother learn to sew also. She wasn't totally gender neutral, but she made him learn how to cook. She believed that everybody who ate needed to know how to cook. Well, my brother went to college in the early 70s and had a dashiki factory, because a dashiki is nothing but three seams. And he made a lot of money, and he didn't need complex skills to do it because of what my mother had taught him. And I get concerned now that we have a lot of children that can't make spaghetti with meat sauce. You know, you could give them ground beef, spaghetti, and tomato sauce, and they would have a hard time producing an edible meal. And I think that we should just really focus on simple things and imparting skills to children. And all of this academic and try to be a better employee and try to be more acceptable, a better cog in the wheel of the machine, isn't going to save us if we happen to have a real economic downturn. Most of us could not survive without a supermarket. And a lot of our food comes from China, and we're not getting along with them so well diplomatically. It just seems that we need to stop focusing as much on politics and a little bit more on survival. You know, what can I do? We own land that's just covered with grass that produces no food. You should at least have a border of greens that grow down the side of your house if you have land. If you live in an apartment, they have lots of systems to grow salad in your house. Most of us know there's a legal industry where people are growing marijuana in their closet. Well, anywhere you can do that, you can grow a tomato. So you could live in a loft apartment in Brooklyn and grow tomatoes. It's if you wanted to, if it was important to you, if it mattered to you, you could learn to do it. The technology exists. All the supplies exist. They'll deliver it all straight to your house. And you can have some food that you control. And I just think with every progressive year, we should become less dependent on other people for our survival. It's just basic sense. You know, you can't go around talking about there's injustice in the world, there's hatred in the world, there's prejudice and discrimination, and not prepare for a situation that might not favor you. If they wanted to decide there was going to be food rationing, you know, what? Where would you be in the hierarchy of people who were going to get fed? And if you're not like a first responder or somebody who's very important, you're not going to get fed necessarily. And the time to figure that out is not when it goes wrong. For instance, if you just bought a 50-pound bag of rice and stuck it in a closet, that could be currency one day that you could barter or trade with somebody for something else that you need. But we don't think that way. We think that we're going to convince people to be kinder, to be more humane, to be more considerate. And there's nothing that indicates that that's what's happening. So I don't like to be negative, but I'd like to say, what would you do if you thought there would never be equal justice, there would never be an acceptance of our humanity, and that there would never be a time when our lives were valued? Let's say we got over that whole issue and said, well, that's not happening. Then what would you plan to do? Too much of our strategies are based on someone else being kind, someone else making concessions, someone else doing the right thing. But what if no one else does the right thing and all we have is our wits, our energy, our hard work, and our integrity to carry us through? What would the strategies be in that case? That's just the position that I'm taking.
Wow. So I'm hearing that you're of the belief that it's very possible, if not probable, that we may find our society in a chaos right here in America, to the extent where we'll have a food shortage. Deborah?
Yeah, well, you know, it's one thing to have faith in God, and it's another thing to have faith in people and government. Because people make mistakes, governments have problems. You know, you can't count. My mother used to tell me, even a good man can die. So, you know, you have to be prepared to carry the weight yourself, no matter who you think is helping you. You can't wake up every day and be certain that somebody's got your back. And we as a people, I think, are a little too trusting on the structures around us. And the problem is, if those structures should fail, we would disproportionately suffer. You know, we have fewer supermarkets that we own. You know, we have, you know, fewer resources that we control. And people, when times get tight, look out for, you know, their friends and family first. And I don't think we feel vulnerable enough. We feel that we're not treated well. We're concerned about what's happening with the criminal justice system, that kind of thing. But we're too trusting. You know, if anything, we want to trust more. Does that make sense to you?
You said if anything, we want to trust more.
Right. That's what we're lobbying for, a system that we can depend on more. When, if you look at the last couple hundred years of history since we got here, there's never been any indication that if we trusted more, we're more vulnerable, we're more compliant, that we could be certain that we would be cared for and that we would not be abused. And it's like one of my friends was having a hard time getting out of a relationship, so I asked, at what point are you trying to get back to? And that person could not identify a single point in the relationship that they wanted to recreate. They missed the potential of the relationship, not the reality. And that's the same thing that's happening in this country with African Americans. We miss the dream. We miss the potential. But there's not a single point in history that we can say, give me that year, give me that point in time, that was golden, we were doing great, our lives have never been better. And I don't think we're willing to accept the fact that we have never achieved what it is we are seeking, and that it may not be possible. I mean, anything that you've never had could possibly be impossible. And if that's the case, we are not without resources. But if we subjugate our efforts to getting somebody else to partner with us, to accept us, to employ us, to care for us, we can't count on that working. But I don't think we have, and I'm not talking about an adversarial relationship, I'm talking about, you know, trying to be self-sufficient.
So I'm thinking back. You said if anything that we have not had may not be possible, but there was a time when that we did better than we are doing now. Now I'm not speaking of, you know, the average income. I'm just speaking of self-sufficiency. I mean, there was times when I was growing up. I'm gonna segment this for just a moment, and when I say that, I'm gonna segment this to talk about African Americans. All right, just as
okay.
an example, if I may, because you know our demographics is predominantly African American, but we have Caucasian, we have Asians, we have Latinos that also tune in, but it's predominantly African American audience, and so just for this point. I can remember a time when, as a child growing up, every one of my buddies, you know, road dogs, you know, from age that I can remember well, you know, 7 to 17, when I was dependent, their parents, and by the way, for the most part, there were parents. Their parents had some kind of a garden, and everybody had a fruit tree. I mean, even if you were in an apartment, there was my grandparents lived in an apartment, a very, you know, significant size apartment. I think there were like eight units in the apartment, and they had a serious grapevine. Even if you were in an apartment complex, there were fruit trees and gardens, but you don't see that now. So I'm wondering, have we taken a step back from something that we did have?
I think we've taken a step back. I found when I first started pushing gardening, people didn't want to hear about it. They associated agriculture with slavery. They associated agriculture with something low class. You know, you're uneducated. You're a laborer, a migrant. You're not, you know. There was a whole period after, like, colleges opened up admissions in the 70s and stuff where people really strove to be bourgeois. You remember, there was a time when you call somebody bourgeois, it was a curse. It was like, oh, you're bourgeois, you know? And that was like, you know, you're not down with the community. You're upwardly mobile to the detriment of your people was the implication. And then it sort of transitioned and let's be bourgeois. Let's have a BMW and you know, fancy clothes and you know, fancy hair and nails and all that other stuff. There was a change in the value system, and people didn't want to touch dirt. Even today, when people want to garden, some of them, they don't want to grow food because that's the kind of thing that poor people do who need the food. I can grow flowers because I have everything. I want to just decorate my life. We have taken a step back. I have a saying, what you don't, you know, value, you don't protect. And what you don't protect will be taken from you. And we were the backbone of agriculture in this country, and we owned a lot of land. And a lot of that land has transferred out of our hands in my lifetime. But we still have a lot of land left. And my point is, we need to look at that land differently. Instead of trying to put some Roundup on it to kill some weeds, we need to look at, can I grow something on that land? You know, right now people want to have a beautiful lawn, and they're not talking about growing food. And unless you're dealing with somebody who hunts, most people do not know how to prepare. They're all meat eaters, but if you gave them alive anything, they would not be able to process it into edible food.
Wow, that's a profound statement.
I ask people, can you get it from, you know, a chicken, can you get it from live to fried? You know, can I give you a chicken walking around, and can you go through a process, and I can come back a couple hours later, and I've got fried chicken? There's a very small percentage of people, male or female, who can accomplish that today. And to me, these are basic skills. If you can't do that, then maybe you should face being a vegetarian because, you know, if they don't have it all chopped up in cellophane, you cannot access meat. Somebody could drop a cow or a pig off at your house, and you don't know what to do. So my whole point is, we should really try a little bit harder to see if we can, you know, like those of us who have family land down south, you know, maybe you want to grow a crop, you know, like oregano, that doesn't have to be replanted. I mean, maybe you should look seriously, like, can I grow lavender or something, just so it's not just sitting there. So it's producing something that the children might be able to harvest and sell. That, the, you know, you tell the children, oh, the lavender is in bloom, go out, harvest lavender, we'll sell it to an oil-producing company and make lavender oil. Something, all business does not have to make you money for it to enrich your life. As long as you're not losing money on it and you might be employing your kids, it's a gain. You know, when we look at business, we want to, like, do what that guy in BET did, you know, get paid, sell it to the man, and be a millionaire. No. Most business in the world sustains families and employs the family members. You know, everybody isn't on, like, this stock market trip of, you know, owning stuff and leveraging stuff. And land is the biggest thing that I think that we've lost a lot of. But I'm saying, okay, you can't survive without food and water. I mean, the fight at Standing Rock and in Clint, Michigan, people should pay attention to that because there's a trend on now to say that, you know, water, clean water, isn't necessarily a right that people have. And you know, we're human beings. You know, the cat, the dog, you or me will not survive without clean water. And I just think we're worried about abstract issues politically. I told one of my relatives that the issues of gender rights and you know, gay marriage and stuff and abortion, it doesn't matter what the government decides to do, most people will not be personally impacted. But you get the whole country arguing about something that won't solve anything, like subprime mortgages. Can we all argue about the banks as opposed to what people are doing with their private lives? I just think that much of what is fed to us as an issue is a distraction, and no matter what you do about it, it won't solve perpetual war and other things that are devastating the planet. There's a whole lot of energy being wasted on issues that, yes, they're important to some people at some time, but they are not the key issues that are going to make or break our society.
What are those key issues?
The key issues that are going to make or break our society is whether or not we believe that every human being has a right to food and shelter. Okay? If we've come to the point where we don't believe that everybody deserves food and everybody deserves to be able to sleep inside, outside the elements, you know, without being suffering heat or cold to an extreme, that's a lack of humanity. The other thing is, when I do business with a bank, I don't expect to be dealt with fraudulently or lied to or deceived or robbed. And if, in fact, I am doing business, you know, they used to say the buyer beware, and somebody consciously tricks, deceives, and defrauds me, they need to be brought to justice. See, there is no law without law enforcement. And people, when they talk about the issue of law enforcement in the black community, it's always excess violence, excess enforcement, excess brutality, when I don't believe that does the most damage. I think the most damage that is done to our people is through strategic negligence, the failure to enforce laws when people violate our rights. You know, the failure to hold people accountable when they have done something wrong. And that has caused great losses. The loss that happened with the foreclosures is the greatest loss of wealth that African Americans have ever suffered. And there was no effort to punish the people who intentionally did this, or to make whole the people who sustain losses. Now, I know if you get beat to death or choked to death, it's a very bad thing for you and everybody who loves you, and traumatic for everybody who watches the video, but that still isn't as devastating as the foreclosures we had from toxic mortgages that were intentionally sold to our people. People went into churches to sell mortgages to congregations. People weren't even looking for a mortgage, and the man found them and told them, I got a great deal for you, and talked people into things they wouldn't have done, causing them to lose everything. But there's no punishment for that. You know, I mean, it's a terrible thing when an unarmed person gets shot to death, or Sandra Bland, you know, ends up dead in jail. But you can't tell me that it is much more of a problem than all these people who lost their houses.
You know, I can relate to that, to break that down a little bit, if I can tag team on that with you. I do talk about it from an economic perspective, so if I can take off on that and then get your perspective on what I'm about to say, I would appreciate that. Because there are those that say, like you just mentioned, wait a minute now. I mean, they're shooting our children in the streets. But you know, that gets back to the whole holistic, organic perspective of that. Why? You know, let's not talk about the symptom for a moment, because the symptom is horrific. The symptom of our children being destroyed in the street, or even our adults being destroyed. But now let's back it up. And let's get to the root of the cause. Is it because of lack of education, which is possibly because of lack of taxable income in a given area? which comes back to wealth or lack of wealth or disparity in the distribution of wealth that are leading to these problems. So you're correct. If you back to the root, then there's empowerment. They prevent some of the things that some people say is the greatest problem.
You got to face a harsh reality. You can be a saint, okay, and your number comes up on the side of the road. And if only black people from troubled backgrounds engaged in negative behavior with criminal records had to worry about this concern, that's one thing, okay? But you and I know that there's a whole lot of criminal white people who do all kinds of terrible things, and it doesn't make every white person look like a thug or a criminal to the people in power. But we have a collective identity, and where white identity often goes to the best people. Even the Beverly Hillbillies were, like, you know, classy, all right? So, right? You know, even like rednecks, they were classy, okay? Where if you, the opposite happens to us, that even the best and brightest amongst us are sometimes, you know, presented as, you know, twisted and perverse and you know, capable of all kinds of things, you know. If now that we're smarter, we just do more devious crimes. You know, we don't, like the black people who are criminals on TV aren't, like, you know, sticking up people and engaging in prostitution. You know, they're bringing down governments and stuff now, you know. It's unfortunately, and that's another problem for us, because we self-correct. Because we think everybody's behavior reflects on us, we spend a lot of time criticizing each other and telling other black people what they shouldn't do, what they shouldn't wear, where they shouldn't go, how they shouldn't act. And freedom starts at home. So if you don't have the desire to let your own people be free, like, you shouldn't be an artist, that's a waste of time. You need to go, you know, make some money. You know, a lot of times we are the ones that are holding each other back, because we have rigid views of what's acceptable and what's not. And it stifles creativity, and it's really hard for children if you want to do something odd or unusual. You know, if you announce to your family that you want to study insects and bugs for the rest of your life, they'll think you're mentally ill. And so I'm just saying that all of us, no matter who you are, your number could come up and you could be unjustly, unfairly murdered at any point. But that's always been true, and it's not worth worrying about every day. It's unfortunate when it happens. Let's hope it doesn't happen, but let's not pretend that the only people at risk are the people who are, you know, viewed as being at risk.
Okay, I understand that this is a systemic problem throughout and threads throughout our nation. Just
mm-hmm.
to segment it again to our nation. We're beyond African Americans.
Right, okay.
But however, there is an unquestionable relationship between income and criminal behavior.
It has been throughout history. Who did
Correct.
They kick out of Europe to colonize this country? Poor people, crooks, thieves, pickpockets, and prostitutes. They decided to grease their crime by sending the poor people far away where they couldn't get back. So poverty and crime has always been connected. But my whole point is, poverty is sometimes enforced on certain people. And crime is sometimes enforced on certain people. I'll give you an example. Okay, everybody paid attention to Baltimore and the police department, all the trouble they got in with Freddie Gray. I read the report on the department, and I was most shocked by the fact that they weren't prosecuting any rapes. So that means if you were a rapist in Baltimore, you didn't have to worry about a thing. You didn't worry about rape kits being prosecuted and your DNA popping up. You could be a serial rapist, and if you were a rape victim, you were not going to get heard or respected or any kind of response. And I'm saying that, you know, we have to look at things a little differently in terms of not letting somebody else tell us what the problem is. You know, we constantly get told about violence in our community, and I'm not sure that our community is any violent, more violent than anybody else's community. And certain places that are hot spots of violence, you know, look at Chicago. Tell me when that was a place where people weren't getting murdered. I mean, just look at Prohibition. Have we caught up with Elliot Ness? Or the Chicago political machine, Daley and his people? See, context is everything. And we don't give ourselves a break. When people are pointing fingers at us and talking about how bad we are, we're like, yeah. And, you know, pull up your pants, too. Instead of saying, you know, this is a town that has had corruption for over 100 years. And unfortunately, you know, it is impacting the current residents. But we didn't invent the crime in Chicago. But you would think we did from the way it's reported. And you would think no one else has ever been a criminal in Chicago but a young black man. And then you would think that the police were never corrupt in Chicago. Oh, gee, that never happened. All I'm saying is that, you know, I think we need to be more honest about what we're up against and stop painting these rosy pictures. And I don't think it has to make you angry to say that it is unfair, it is unjust, I am discriminated against. The sight of me bothers some people. I live in a segregated community. I am not welcome every place I go outside of my community. You can say that without being angry. But once you accept that, then, like, okay, what kind of strategies am I going to have for me to have a better life? It's the only life God gave me. I plan to enjoy it. No matter how people feel about black women, I'm going to feel good about my life. You have to take a stand for yourself. But you don't have to lie to yourself to try to feel good.
Well, you know, it's not just about lying. It's about saying something, period. And too often things are not spoken on. We had a little discussion about...
No, you're right about that. I used to always say we'd go to these meetings in town, and nobody would say anything in the meeting. And they'd ask, does anybody have questions? Anybody? And then after the meeting's over, they all get in the parking lot and huddle. And then they go home and call each other up. And that the real meeting takes place after the meeting. But nobody's willing to stand up and face the people in authority and express their concerns right then and there. And I think it's a bad habit to be non-confrontational. And it's not just a trait with African Americans, because a lot of women from all cultures are non-confrontational. Because people who feel they're going to be hurt for having an opinion that's not appreciated often decide, I'm going to keep that to myself. And it takes a certain amount of courage to say things that you think people may not want to hear. And a lot of people think it's not worth the time, effort, and energy to do that. So we need to have more courage and to not be devastated if people don't like us.
And I don't know if it's just women, which is dangerous in itself. You made a statement earlier, uncharacteristically cowardice.
Yeah. No, a lot of people, like, they're not ashamed to be a coward. They'll let you know right up front, you know, I ain't getting involved with that. I'm not going out on a limb. It's like people are almost proud of the fact that they are self-protective, you know. I'm not getting involved with that. And the problem is that not only do you need to care about yourself, you need to care about your community. And if you're non-confrontational and avoid saying anything people don't want to hear, you can't advocate to make things better. But I don't know what happened. First of all, there's never been a period in life where all people were much safer than you are right now in the United States of America. No matter what they say about crime and no matter how afraid some people are of violence, statistically, you know, even with, you know, the cops shooting people and everything, almost everybody is better off now in terms of the odds of you dying a violent death than at any prior point in history. But people are more afraid than ever. When you think of all those people who got on the bus, the Freedom Riders down south, you know, the people who died in the civil rights movement, the other people who carried on after people died, that's not the spirit we have today. You know,
when
people
did that
pardon me?
Deborah, when do you think that shift took place?
Was it the 70s, the 80s? I'm going to say something that's a little controversial. Sometime in the 80s, when that whole thing with the secret and prosperity theology took hold. See, I was raised on liberation theology, and the whole narrative of like 30% of your church services was, you know, freedom from slavery, you know, leaving Egypt, crossing the River Jordan, being delivered. It was all about the deliverance of the people, not just you personally, the deliverance of your people, freedom of our people. God save our people. And then it morphed into prosperity for me. So instead of me looking for the liberation, the freedom, the civil rights, the uplifting of all of us, I now am vibing on a new car, a new house, a new job, for me personally. And my relationship with God is so I get stuff back from God. And I think that devastated the black community, because we never had the exact same Christianity as the Western church coming out of Europe. It's always been a different kind of African Christianity that was promised by, practiced by the slaves. But at the same time that New Age hit the dominant culture, we absorbed some of that. And I think it made people feel comfortable with being self-centered and materialistic, which was never acceptable in our parents' generation. For you to be, you were looked down on if you were self-centered and materialistic. And instead of praise and you know, highly favored, you know, if you have a lot of money, a nice car and stuff, it's almost like, hey, God co-signed me, you know. Look at me, how well I'm doing. It makes me a better person even spiritually because I have these material gains. And I think it really has undermined our value system.
Yeah. It's almost like a spiritual trickle-down approach. And I say that because I think about, and not to go into to politics, but I can tell you, we come towards the end, bottom of the hour, because I haven't even touched upon the political fray, but I'm gonna just dabble, stick my toe in there, because I'm gonna ask you to come back, because I know the lines are blowing up and folks want to talk, and this is a dialogue that I believe needs to take place. So let me just go where I was headed with that. I can remember in the 80s, I believe it was under Reagan, that there was this this conversation about trickle down. And
mm-hmm.
this is a discourse that I think has to happen. That we have a spiritual or religious trickle down theory that infiltrated into the churches. Remember, the CDCs began coming out about that time. Everybody had a CDC. community development.
Well, you know what was the deciding factor? When the government gave faith-based money to churches. Not all churches
and you
qualified
on toes,
for that. But when the law was changed, that stopped activist clergy. Because
Pardon me? You're stepping on some toes, but go ahead. That's what I love to do on
No, I'm just saying that, you know, you can get a call from a politician now and say if you, like, keep opposing something, you know, that might impact that money you need for the roof. I mean, see, once you factor that money into your budget and adjust to having that, the thought of somebody taking that from you could be devastating, especially since many of these churches have old buildings, dwindling, congregations. You know, when people started losing their jobs and their houses, they couldn't tithe anymore. That whole prosperity thing went down with the subprime mortgages. A whole lot of churches have gone bankrupt and closed because the people don't have the money. Everybody lost. You know, so I'm just saying to you, I had a problem. I don't mind the separation of church and state. In fact, you know, I come from six generations of clergy, but I like the separation of church and state. And I don't think it's constructive. And you're right. People had these community development corporations, and they were going to build housing, and they were going to get involved. I think we as a people need churches who are about saving our souls and teaching us how to repent and turn from our sinful ways, as opposed to building, you know, subsidized housing and low-income housing. You know, the church in our community does everything. No other community expects their church to do everything. Anything. Stop violence. Let's go to the church, okay? After-school program. Let's go to the church. You know, whatever our needs are, we think that institution is the primary source of the solution. And it's distracting people from the fact that we need to really have, like, spiritual renewal.
I would agree with that. I mean, there are, you know, your church community may take issue with that, and perhaps we'll have to have some of that dialogue on with some of the church leaders around the and just have that uncommon discourse. It needs to happen. You say we got to get out the parking lot and into the mainstream of what's going on and what's impacting us. And there's a political.
And we have to be able to disagree without being disagreeable, and not need everybody to love us and agree with us. You know, there's a whole lot of discussions that we just can't have because people just can't tolerate certain levels of truth. There's a lot of problems right now going on, tensions between black men and women, and it's hard to find a productive conversation where people just aren't, like, you know, flinging their emotions at each other.
Let me throw one at you. Because Deborah, as I knew you would, you've opened up some minds, and I know our listeners, and my phone's ringing off the hook here because there's some folks that can't get in, so we're having a technical issue. Deborah, not to put you on the spot, but that's what I do sometimes. I need you to have a conversation with me offline after we're done because we're going to the bottom of the hour. But I would like to continue this because we haven't even gotten into the political fray. And folks are not able to get in right now for some technical reason, but because it's my program, I'm able to say, well, you know what? As soon as Ms. Dahl is available, we're going to continue this. We're not going to let a little technical issue, because there are folks that want to comment and have this uncommon discourse. Phone's blowing up. So would you be willing to have that conversation with me offline so we can get you to come back and reschedule? We can open the lines up?
Sure. I've always willing to have, you know, discussions with people on a wide variety of subjects. I'm a very open-minded person, and I'm also curious. So I'd love to hear what people are thinking.
So the only reason you're not hearing is because I can't open the lines up, and we'll get that corrected. I'll get with my engineer really soon for our next program. So I'm going to leave a carrot out as we go to the bottom of the hour, and we have to close out for the folks. And I'll let you comment at about 50,000 feet, not into any detail, just to put that carrot in. Folks will be looking forward to when you return. I think a lot of the common thread, and not to just to point the finger, but you know, my perspective, that the political fray is causing a lot of this. And what triggered my statement of this is when you said you have black men, black women, you got older men, older women, older men and younger men, older women and younger women going at each other, not just across race lines, but period. And I see a lot of that tied in with the political fray. I mean, this last political upheaval, I mean, I've got family members that won't talk to me because I've said, well, I can think of one thing that the man did that was decent. I'm not in bed with Trump. I don't support what this man is doing. But I have to speak truth to power. And I'm not freaking out because he's in power, there are people that won't speak to me. And I'm not going to freak out because if I freak out, I can't function. So we got a couple of minutes. And so if you'll be brief, as intentionally, because I want to pick up where on this when you return, and we're going to go into some other conversations, because I know our listeners now understand why I said that you're a remarkable mind, and I'm not patronizing you. I'm too old. I don't play those games. But you do have so much of value in your insight. So speak to that momentarily, if you would, in terms of political being involved with a lot of this.
All of my friends know that I was concerned. I tell a joke. I said Barack Obama anesthetized racism, and then white people had to work real hard to wake it back up, and that I was very afraid that the same thing would happen if a woman was elected, because you can hide a whole lot of injustice behind somebody that represents a disenfranchised population. So that our best hope for everybody to be woken up and become activists would be the nastiest white man you could find. And people thought I was perverse when I said this during the primaries. Bernie Sanders would not have triggered, as president, the wave of activism we're seeing now. And as painful as it might be for people, people had peace of mind they didn't deserve, that they had realities and facts they were ignoring and not confronting, and that's over now. And so people are acting like, I've never heard racism out of the mouths of white people this much in my entire life. I heard somebody on TV talking about white supremacy. None of this would have happened if this man was not president. And it's unfortunate, and I hope it's not too late, but finally, people are realizing we have some unsolved issues that we've been avoiding and sidestepping and pretending things were all right when they weren't.
And
he
it didn't start.
The,
didn't
start
and it
What'd
didn't
you say?
Start with this administration.
No, it didn't. But what I find most interesting is the people who are most upset and angry are the people who have not been activists at all. During the 80s and 90s. The people who did not go to the meetings, did not go to rallies, did not participate in any kind of advocacy, who were, you know, living their life and consuming their consumer products are hysterical now. And I find it the people who I know who have been fighting for, like, nonprofit prisons and all of that other stuff, those people are, like, resting. They're, like, exhaling. They're like, oh, good. Somebody noticed we're in trouble. So the people who were accused of being conspiracy theorists all during the 90s and stuff are the calmest. And the people who were the most upwardly mobile and successful are the ones that tend to be in a panic. So maybe at some point, you know, You know, people have to catch up with their concerns. Because if you were not upset, that doesn't mean you shouldn't have been. You had peace of mind you didn't deserve. So you should be grateful for those years that you didn't care, that you were able to, like, you know, do whatever, go to the Bahamas and stuff and vacation and, you know, have a good time. But that's over now. And you can't just be mad because you cannot, you know, turn off and tune out and consume, you know, food, drink, and images. I think this man was the only candidate running for office that could have unleashed a social justice movement that spans all demographics. And the price has to be paid. The price of ignorance, the price of neglect, of negligence, has to be paid. And it's unpleasant, but that's better than the way we were going, where we weren't facing reality, facing truth, and letting all kinds of people suffer terrible consequences that we just ignored.
Wow. Well, well stated. Well stated. Well, to our listener who joined in late, my apologies for you not being able to comment, but we will be reaching back with Deborah. If we'll find out. If she's available even next week, if I have to do some adjustments. We're going to continue this, and we want you, the listener, to get involved in this uncommon discourse, if I can refer to it. And so we appreciate those of you who did tune in. We look forward to you tuning in and continuing this dialogue where you can participate and share Progressive News Weekly. If you'd like to get on the mail list, it's Daryl, Daryl_CLA18 at MSN.com. We have been having a discourse with Ms. Deborah Dow, the true philanthropist, agricultural, self-sustained lifestyle expert, as you have heard, and a true advocate. Civil rights, and spoken on that and all. So, Ms. Dow, we appreciate you. We're looking forward to hopefully you coming back in the next couple of weeks, depending on your business. You're in demand. Everyone wants to pull you for your business. But I'm going to reach back to you after the program and see when we can have you on. Truly been a treat and a thrill. And I appreciate it, and I know listeners do as well. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Daryl. I appreciate it also.
I'll be reaching out, and as I said, depending on your schedule, hopefully we can continue the dialogue in the next week or two ahead. I really don't want to go out more than that. We'll talk about it offline. So, we have come to the end of another program, and we never give up. And that just takes me to an old Al Jarreau song, ever giving up. We never give up. And I thank you for tuning in again. Tell us about Progressive News, and you can be sure we have Ms. Deborah Dow back in the future if there's any way. Last week, I've been afraid that I had missed the chance to live my life. And by the way, I'm tumbled with romance, girl, and I don't cry, but now I